Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
When I walked into the Oregonian newsroom like 20 years ago, one of the tent poles in the room was wearing what I think were rubber galoshes. I think Bill Monroe had the best job. Outdoor writer, fishing, hunting, he wrote about it all. He continues to write about it all. I'll tell you about some projects that he has going, but I wanted to drag him on the show in part to talk about, you know, what's going on with fishing. You can find Bill Monroe's work now at theguidesforecast.com. He is writing a column there, and he's posted one today about boating and fishing. And, you know, if you want to know what's going on with fishing in the outdoors and hunting, Bill Monroe's your guy, and I'm bringing him on now. Was that galoshes that you wore in the newsroom? What were you wearing?
They were probably muck boots, but they're kind of Oregon galoshes, I guess. They're insulated.
You had the coolest job because you could probably expense your boat on your tax return. As you know, that was your job.
Yes, and the newspaper bought me a little outboard motor.
Love
you
that.
Remember Dick Johnston?
It's only money.
I turned in a receipt one time to repair it, and he says we have an outboard motor.
That's great.
Yeah. No, I've been very, very fortunate, John.
Yeah, let me talk, Bill. You know, when I get a lot of emails from fishermen who are now saying fish counts are down. You know, the guides are complaining. You got the view from 20,000 feet. What do you see out there now? And what should we be telling fishermen?
It's early. It's too early to get too worked up about it. The Willamette catches for the month of March were lower than usual, but it still could explode almost at any time. And as for the Columbia, yeah, they had a tough time catching fish, but they usually do up until about the 15th of April when they're not allowed to fish that run anymore because they've got to get the fish over Bonneville Dam into the tribal nets and make sure they at least have some fish. So it's early. And If you look at the comparisons with the last several years, the graphs and charts all show that, you know, we're tracking. It's just too early to tell. So I just, you know, fishermen, especially in the spring, are notorious for not having much patience, and I don't blame them at all. I feel the very same. But I'm sitting in my office. I'm looking outside at my dogwood tree, and it's nowhere near blooming pink, which has been the rule of thumb in the past years. When the dogwoods bloom, then the fishing turns on. So it's early. Just calm down, relax. At least you're out fishing. That's good, especially given this past year. If you're out fishing, then you're having a good day.
I love that. Bill Monroe with us, longtime outdoor writer on fishing and hunting. He is the outdoorsman. You can read his stuff now at theguidesforecast.com. Got to get the Chinook membership. What are you doing on theguidesforecast.com?
Well, they approached Buzz Ramsey and I, and Buzz, of course, is an icon to fishermen around the world, in fact. They approached us because they're expanding what they do, the kind of information that they create for members, paid members, and they wanted us to be in on the paid membership. So we both agreed, and it gives me a little bit of an outlet besides my monthly column and some news at the Oregonian. So I said yes, and it's just it's been a bit of a release for me because I get to expand and have a little more flexibility than I do at the Oregonian. in a past with the Oregonian, of course, I was riding more often, and I had a lot of flexibility, but I don't anymore because there's so much news, and you've got to pack it all into once a month. But this is just the guides forecast is run by Bob Reese and his brother Doug, and it's very well done, and they rely on local guides, and unlike a lot of fishing and resorts, they call a spade, and if it's not good, they'll tell you it's not good. And Buzz and I will do the same. I follow mostly government things and regulations and perspective. Buzz is a how-to guru, and we'll play well off of each other.
Bill Monroe, our guest. Bill, you talked about government regulations. What are you seeing right now that is helping sort of the scene in fish and wildlife, and what are you seeing that needs to be done?
Which side of the cobweb does the spider start with? I don't know. There are insects flying into this complexity of management in every single direction. It all depends on, Oregon in the Northwest, John. After I left the military, after the war, I just vowed I would never leave the Northwest because it's absolutely a special place on this planet, and it still is, regardless of all of the problems. That said, it just kind of depends on where you're looking. Trout fishing is good. I guess habitat is the biggest. Yeah, trout, everything goes back to habitat, and that's why I put a lot of effort into habitat. So I guess that's the main, or our main concern now is meeting some challenges of global, I don't say warming, but climate change, meeting those challenges with as much as we could do to improve habitat and allow these fish to make the adjustments that they'll need. So that's the main thing. But, we've got so much on our plate. You can still fish every single day of the year in Oregon and Washington too, for that matter, and expect to catch something. And we've got so many good things that are happening that nobody pays a lot of attention to because, the squeaky wheels are always the loudest where the oil is needed the most. And of course that's why you're getting those calls. And I get the emails and calls I think the salmon situations are going to be, they're going to turn around. The coho this year is going to be excellent. And the biggest issues right now in the Columbia are trying to get the states of Oregon and Washington to agree on allocations. Commercial fishing has a place on the Columbia, and it needs to change, but they're working through how to make those changes. And again, the habitat is... And then, of course, like the Department of Fish and Wildlife says, as the climate changes and things warm up, anglers are going to have to maybe change some of the ways they fish. And the squeaky wheels are largely, John, they're largely from the salmon and steelhead fishermen because those are the money fish and the glamour fish. But still, two-thirds to three-quarters of all anglers in this region are after just basics, the trout, and yes, the invasive bass and panfish. And it could be that a lot of people will just have to change the way they fish and what they fish for. And they'll do that because as the recent increase in license sales has proven, people are interested in getting outside, especially after a year and a half like we've just been through and are still in. People just want to be outside doing something, and fine, they'll go fishing. We just have to make sure that we're managing responsibly and always with habitat. It's location, location, location. We've just got to make sure that we keep things clean.
Bill Monroe
kind of rambling,
with us. No, it's gold. I mean, it's absolute gold. If I want to get perspective or expertise on the outdoors, fishing, hunting. It's Bill Monroe I go to. Longtime Oregonian outdoors writer. You can also catch him as he is doing some work for the guidesforecast.com. Bill, you know, I have friends out of state who will visit. They say, hey, it's the spring Chinook salmon run. They're, you know, I'd like to catch a fish. What do you tell people from the your phone must blow up with Bill, I want to catch a fish. Like, you know, that's a lot of pressure.
They have your phone number, John, not mine. Yeah, it's pressure. But people come to Oregon. Well, there are a couple of different kinds of people who want to come to Oregon to catch a spring Chinook. Okay. Then they're going to have to pick their time, and they're going to have to wait like the locals are doing right now, and until we know a little bit better when and where fishing will pick up. And then the other kind is the people, hey, we're coming next week. We want to catch a spring Chinook. What do we do?
Yeah, right.
Well, there is that old card game, go fish, but you find a guide that knows the most and hope for the best. And if it is one of those guides that knows the most, it's likely he's booked. And so you just kind of have to take the chances. So if you have friends coming, then tell them to plan their trip a little, you know, be a little more flexible about when and where. Last year, you know, we had the same kind of slow start on the Willamette. And by the middle of May through the end of June, there was just knockout spring Chinook fishing, to everyone's surprise, down in the lower Willamette. So it was just, you know, the vagaries of fish and the tides and what they want. You know, if I could think like a fish, I wouldn't be in this business. I'd be making $1 million somewhere.
Bill Monroe is with us. You know, I think about fishing, but we don't talk a lot about hunting on this show. What do you see out there in the hunting world? What are people talking about?
Well, actually, last season wasn't all that bad for both deer and elk in Oregon. I'm not sure about Washington. The duck season started out well and then got a little bit slow. The goose season was good. We've got lots of geese. Hunting is okay. It's not in a great place, and there's still a lot to do. And again, habitat and try to cope with fires and climate change and the rest of it. And they're doing that as well. But the hunters they're finding other places to go. Turkey season is on us next week on the 15th, and Oregon is one of the most liberal turkey seasons in the nation at three birds. Hunting is going to be okay. The bow hunters right now are having to face some restrictions because it's just become so popular that there are just too many of them in some places. But those are all, you know, they're growing pains. And hunting in Oregon has got a good future, and it's we still got, what, I think the state is 52% public land, which is a good thing. So I'm not as pessimistic about hunting as I am about some of the fisheries.
Let me ask you about a couple of the controversial things, Bill. You know me; I want to get into this, roll up the sleeves. What about the fenced hunts that happen? What's the latest? I know like a decade ago, there was sort of some backlash. Have there been regulations set up to make that more palatable? Or how? When I say fenced hunt, what does Bill Monroe do?
I don't fence hunt. It's a high fence. I don't do that. I don't agree with it. Wildlife is wildlife. It's not something that belongs behind a fence so that somebody can come in and shoot it.
Yeah.
And no, we don't have we have what's called cervid regulations, and cervid is a grazer like deer and elk. So we have regulations about raising cervids. But high fence hunting isn't, you know, it's popular in places in the South, Texas especially, where that for a lot of people is, you know, states with 90% or more private land, that's the only way people can go hunting. But we don't have that here in Oregon, so we don't have very many high fence hunts. It sure grabs headlines, and it's, to me, it's just, it's ethically immoral. In our region.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like that's not a fair fight.
No, it's not hunting. No, it's I say that knowing that we're a free nation and everyone has their own idea about what things should be, and especially with the internet, there are now 350 million of us, each with our own opinion, and ours is much better than the other 349 million, et cetera. But there are opinions, but that's mine, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
How about the sea lions? I haven't heard a lot about the sea lions. Has that problem been solved?
No, not at all. But it's in the process of, and anybody that wants to buy into the guides forecast will find my column this week about sea lions. We finally got permission from the government to euthanize, which is take and kill, the large stellar sea lions. They weigh up to more than a ton. It's problematic because then you got to go catch them, and that's a very difficult proposition. Yeah. You can't simply start shooting them. You can't euthanize them wherever they appear because you don't know where they're going to go or fall in the water and die. You don't want that to happen. So you have to trap them and then take them to a location, humanely euthanize them with drugs, and then turn them over to rendering services. But a few years back, we finally got permission to trap sea lions at Willamette Falls, and I believe they got, like, I just wrote this too, 33, I think, California sea lions, which are the smaller ones. And then just last month in March, they got a big stellar up there in a trap, and they were able to euthanize it. They got 6 stellars at Bonneville last fall. So the sea lion problem is abating, but it's certainly not over by any means, and they'll be probably in both locations here very soon, and the states, Oregon and Washington, and the tribes are starting to trap them, and they watch the traps daily, and they'll get after it. It's been a very slow process, in fact, slower than the sea lions were making inroads against wild steelhead.
Let me ask you.
That problem seems to be on the mend. Go ahead.
Bill, I've got a couple minutes here. I want to get at, like, when did the sea lions become a problem and why? Like, has this been an ongoing thing and we just became aware of it? Or, you know, and I understand as they were trapping them and taking them back to the ocean, they were just swimming right back up.
Well, they didn't just take them back to the ocean. They took a couple of them all the way to California, and they almost beat the vehicles back. Historically, before dams, there hadn't been that many sea lions. Although Lewis and Clark first described the harbor seal in the Dalles when they came through in 1804, which was interesting. They thought it was a large otter, but historically, there haven't been that many in the Columbia until they built the dams, and the sea lions, they started discovering that fish, especially the males, are the ones that are the biggest offenders. It's almost all males. They're up there just before breeding season. They've got to put on fat because it's just like elk. They've got to put on some fat because they're going to go down and host a bunch of ladies, and they've got to put on the calories. But they discovered that they could get these fish up there, and so they started appearing in high numbers back actually in the 60s. And the Corps of Engineers, many people don't realize this, but the Corps of Engineers hired sharpshooters to go out and take out sea lions, and they got them by the hundreds. And the problem kind of went away for a while, and then Then they started showing up. Well, the Marine Mammal Protection Act happened in the 70s, and that started protecting them from being outright killed. And they started showing up in pretty high numbers starting in the 1990s, about the mid-90s, early 90s. And that was the California sea lions. And the Stellars followed them in and started really doing some damage to huge sturgeon, especially below Bonneville, in the primary spawning grounds for large sturgeon. And it was through the 90s through the, up until about 10 years ago is when the big influx came. Right now, there are more California sea lions in existence than there were historically. Their numbers are somewhere around 300,000 out on the ocean.
Bill Monroe, you can read him on Oregon Live. You can also catch his work in the guidesforecast.com, and we will drag him on this show a couple times a year to bring his expertise here. Bill, I appreciate you. You're always good to me, and I appreciate your work. You're just fantastic. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking me, John, and I sent you a separate email, too.
I got it. Bill Monroe, there he is, outdoor writer, fishing expert, hunter, man of the world, probably wearing his galoshes still to this very moment. Leave it here. Every day on the program, we do the big splash. It's the one thing that you need to know today.
This is
the one thing you absolutely need to know today.
Look at it. Where?
Down there. Must be
the big splash. Brought to you by the Exergen Twice Daily Thermometer.
Well, the Blazers hung around against the Utah Jazz, at least for a little while. Eventually got blown out 122-103. Third quarter, particularly bad for the Blazers, really was the difference. They gave up 40 points in that third quarter, got beat 40-19, lost the game. Defensively, they were bad. Enes Kanter, Carmelo Anthony in particular.
It hasn't been good for long stretches. But with Nurk coming back in the rotation, that's kind of the way it works. And we've had, over the long haul, defensively, it has not been good. So that is a concern, and we have to work through it.
Been hearing the Blazers talk about defense for a while. Peter Sampson, this is not a good defensive team. They can talk about it all they want. They're not good defensively. They're not a top half of the Western Conference playoff picture team, meaning they're probably somewhere 5-9 ultimately, and that's just who they are.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line. I wouldn't be surprised to see them head into the play-in scenario. And of course, they'll win the play-in and get in, and it'll be fun for fans before a real playoff team grinds them to dust.
Really difficult. Wondering about Terry Stotts' job security after a game like that, because it is the same old, and you...
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.